morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 18th of June. First hour of our program today, we talk about the elections in Iran, in which a reformist-backed presidency, Hassan Rouhani, will be taking over. And one of our guests writes for the Associated Press and says the ecstatic outpouring of Iranians dancing and celebrating in the streets on Saturday night and Sunday reflected the hopes that Rouhani can bring an end to the domination of hardliners for the past 8 years under Ahmadinejad. We're going to be talking about this change in the presidency, and we'll be looking at relations with the United States, the future of the nuclear program, and look quite more extensively at the background, and it's a fascinating background, of the new president of Iran. Brian Murphy is bureau chief in the United Arab Emirates Associated Press. He has covered Iranian affairs for nearly 15 years. A little bit later, we will be speaking with Ervan Abrahamian, who's a professor of Iranian and Middle Eastern history and politics at Baruch College, City University of New York, and author of a number of books on Iran. We start with Brian, who's been covering this story for the AP. Brian, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. It's a pleasure.
So why were they dancing in the streets?
Well, this is a culmination of 4 years of frustration, 4 years of crackdowns, 4 years of feeling politically marginalized after the disputed election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad back in 2009. Not many people gave Hassan Rouhani much of a chance when he was cleared to run. His campaign gained momentum and brought in a lot of people who probably would have boycotted the election if they didn't feel there was a chance. So what you saw was hope in the future, but also a kind of collective sigh of relief for a lot of people after 4 years of being under a lot of pressure.
You write in your piece that Iran's presidency is still without the tools to take any major initiatives without clearance from the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, or by extension, the Revolutionary Guard. What power does the supreme leader have?
Well, the supreme leader has, as his name would suggest, supreme power. He can stop any initiative, start any initiative, begin any initiative. In many ways, everything of significance passes through him or his inner circle, and this includes the Revolutionary Guard, whose power should just—it's hard maybe to grasp if you just call it a military force. It has an intelligence gathering aspect. It controls the aerospace industry. It controls defense. So it's a huge power under his umbrella. What the president has at his disposal is the ability to kind of nudge and advise this big apparatus, this big machinery above him. So the direct power of the presidency is limited on paper, but as it was shown in a previous administration by a previous reformist president, Mohammad Khatami, from 1997 to 2005, it can bring some significant changes if allowed. And I think that's what needs to be understood, if allowed.
I'm a little confused here. Did the supreme commander give the go-ahead? Does he need to give the go-ahead for people to run for the presidency?
He doesn't specifically. There's a group called the Guardian Council, which is a 12-member body which vets all the candidates. More than 680 people registered for this election.
Oh, my.
Among them... very prominent names, including a former president, Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, and you know there were kind of fringe and you know very whimsical people registered too, as you can imagine. But eight people were cleared, and Rouhani was among them, of course. When you're trying to grasp the Iranian political system, this gatekeeping role is a really is the main tool that they have to sway the election. The candidate pool this time was heavily weighted in favor of establishment-friendly candidates. Rouhani was a bit of a consolation prize to reformists. But anyone who's cleared is certainly not an outsider, not a radical force, not someone who doesn't have some kind of connection and blessing from the system. So, you know, when we call him a reformist, of course, it's a reformist within the context of the leadership of Iran.
They really didn't clear very many people, did they?
No, they don't. No, they. I was surprised, actually, at eight. I thought it would be more like eventually six people were on the ballot, two dropped out. But in previous years, there's been fewer than eight. So one big surprise was knocking the former president, Rafsanjani, as I mentioned. And they also took a swipe at the outgoing president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, by knocking his political protege from the final ballot list as well. So there were some surprises even before the voting began.
You've covered politics in Iran for 15 years. Were you surprised by Rouhani's victory?
It didn't surprise me that much, really. When we did interviews before the election, his name was mentioned quite frequently. I have to say, I lost the office pool because I was thinking Tehran's mayor was going to win, so I didn't personally predict his victory. But it certainly didn't surprise me in the sense that once he started to get momentum, many people, millions of people, in fact, who would have probably boycotted, lined up behind his candidacy. So once he started to draw big rallies 2 or 3 days before the election, it seemed he had a real credible shot.
And how do they go about campaigning? You mentioned big rallies. Do they do television interviews? Do they run ads?
Yeah, they do.
Really?
It's not so much different than a Western campaign, although, you know, to Western eyes, it might appear a little scripted and stilted. They have debates, but they don't really, the format isn't so much debating each other. They're posed questions, and they answer in turn, although there was a bit of back and forth between the candidates. They're allowed to have rallies, and they have, you know, just standard kind of political rallies with campaign colors and banners and so forth. They do put out their own sort of video biographies on state TV. So the voters do get to know the candidates, and they do have, you know, the political salesmanship that goes with any campaign.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the West has been worried for some time about Iran moving toward a nuclear weapon. Did Rouhani talk about that at all during the campaign? What do you expect, considering his background as a former nuclear negotiator? Where do you expect him to move on this issue?
Well, he gave some hints yesterday at his first post-victory news conference. He, of course, talked about the paths of moderation, outreach to the West. He drew some clear lines about how far he'd go on these subjects. But on the nuclear issue, he has made numerous references, particularly during the campaign, to his time as nuclear negotiator when there were offers on the table for greater transparency with Iran's nuclear program. And he also was very critical of one of his opponents, the current nuclear negotiator, in fact, Saeed Jalili, saying that Iran didn't do itself any favors by being obstructionist, by seeming to be intransigent, and bringing sanctions on the country and having the nuclear dossier sent to the UN Security Council. So he's very critical of sanctions, and I think, and certainly others do as well, that his emphasis will be on trying to make a pitch that the Iranian nuclear program should have more transparency, more openness, and in turn, this should be rewarded with sanctions being lifted.
And finally, what happens to Ahmadinejad at this point in time? Where does he go, and does his influence kind of completely wane here?
That's a really good question, and it's on the question of the minds of a lot of Iranians. He, like, you know, every former president, he somewhat fades away. He does, though, have a significant power base still, a popularity among people in provinces and rural areas where he gave a lot of government programs and gained a lot of, a lot of high profile because of that. Immediately, you might expect some political payback. As yesterday, the parliament speaker and others filed a lawsuit against him for, it's unknown what it's about, but he had made a lot of accusations against the family of the parliament speaker. So once he's out of office, which happens in August, the transfer happens about 2 months from now, and there might be a lot of political payback, political feuds, score settling, which really shows that Iranian politics can be a bit cutthroat and heavy-handed as well.
Mm-hmm. He was quite a figure, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he, he transformed the presidency in ways that from the Western perspective may not be so agreeable, but he did turn the presidency into a position as the premier international envoy of the country. Before that, of course, the presidents did the same role, but not with the same degree of flamboyance and publicity seeking. So what? And also, he also changed politics inside Iran by trying to challenge the powers of the supreme leader. So he was seen at the beginning as very much a person who would work within the system, and that turned out almost the exact opposite. He was very disruptive internally, and of course, his statements ruffled diplomatic feathers around the world.
Mm-hmm. Brian, thank you very much for your analysis of what happened in Iran. I appreciate your being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Brian Murphy, Bureau Chief in the United Arab Emirates for Associated Press, joining us by phone from Dubai this morning. He has been covering Iranian affairs for nearly 15 years. We continue our conversation and we'll be welcoming phone calls. We're asking the question, who is this new president of Iran? He has a very interesting background, and our guest, the next part of the show, knows the story of his whole life. Ervand Abrahamian will be joining us, professor of Iranian and Middle Eastern history and politics at Baruch City University of New York. Professor Abrahamian was born in Iran and raised in England and is author of Iran Between Two Revolutions, The Iranian Mojahideen, Khomeinism, Tortured Confessions, and Inventing the Axis of Evil. He's currently working on two other books, The CIA Coup in Iran and A History of Modern Iran. We'll be welcoming your phone calls. Here's how you can reach our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, if you would like to leave messages there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Ervand Abrahamian, thank you very much for joining us to give us a better understanding of this new president of Iran. You say, given the parties that have not been seen in many years on the streets in Iran, it almost seemed as if some sort of reformist had been elected. And yet, You say that he is from the center of the political spectrum, and I found this an interesting description. In Iranian context, it means you don't pick fights with the ruling class, and at the same time, you pander to popular grievances people are having about the ruling class.
Yes, I mean, he is an insider, but I think his success, the secret of his success, was that in the last week, he did basically reach out to what we would call reformers or the Green Movement, the people who were disenchanted by the 2009 election. And the fact that Khatami, the liberal previous president, came out in his support gave a real boost to the campaign. This is why I think it was very much a surprise, the outcome. So in a way, I wouldn't label him as a typical reformer, but certainly a person who wants to bring about more of an opening into the Islamic Republic.
How did he reach out to reformers during the campaign?
Well, the fact that he was sort of backed by Khatami and also Rafsanjani, who had been disqualified, but clearly Rafsanjani would also was appealing more to people who wanted opening up of the system. Their endorsement was a great help. But also the fact that he's talked about the need to release political prisoners. These are issues that are very sensitive and really appeal to the whole spectrum of reformers.
How many political prisoners are there, and who are they?
There are many. People who've borne the brunt of it are actually journalists. After 2009 election, the people who worked with newspapers, magazines, did expose articles about corruption. They were really were hounded by the regime. And many, of course, fled the country, but the ones that had stayed had been incarcerated. So there's a high percentage of journalists who are in prison. So I think one of the first things the new president will have to grapple with is how is he going to get some of these people out. And, of course, what was mentioned yesterday at this press conference, a journalist brought up the issue of Mousavi, who was a reform candidate before, who's been in jail, basically under house imprisonment since 2009. There would be great basically for pressure on Rouhani to do something about that.
Uh-huh. And how would he go about securing the release? What steps do you have to take to have that happen?
Well, his problem would be that this is something which the judiciary has to deal with. It's not something that the executive can order. But he can, try to bring pressure on the supreme leader, on the judiciary, to, if they have charges against Mousavi, to bring these charges. Otherwise, as a citizen, there's no reason why he should be incarcerated at home. And I think what the system is actually much more complicated than saying there is a supreme leader who makes all the decisions. There's a problem, I think, in the definition of leader. The leader in the Iranian constitution is not like what we would use as a leader, someone who tells everyone what to do. He's more of a supreme arbitrator, someone who balances different groups. And now that this so-called supreme leader realizes there's a strong reform movement or desire for opening up, he is much more likely to listen to that voice than just to say ignore it, because he knows over 50% of the population have, after all, voted for Rouhani. And if Rouhani now talks about individual rights and rule of law, that is something that Khamenei, the supreme leader, will have to take account of.
We're going to try and switch phones here. We're hearing most of what you say, but it's a little bit interrupted, so we're going to try and get you on another phone line and welcome phone calls and continue. I always am interested in how people spend the early part of their lives, and our guest, Ervan Abrahamian, has studied pretty carefully the memoir of the new president of Iran, and so we will hear about the studies that he took and how he formed his political philosophy. Tomorrow during this time period, I do want to let you know that Jonathan Alter will be with us. Jonathan is a really fine writer, and he has looked quite carefully at the Obama presidency in a previous book, and this book is another one that looks at going up to the 2012 election and partisanship in the country, and well, it's just very well done. The book is The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. Jonathan Alter will be with us tomorrow during this time period. He's a columnist for Bloomberg View and an analyst and contributing correspondent for NBC News and MSNBC. He's written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, Vanity Fair, The New Republic, and a number of other publications. So he will be with us during the first hour of tomorrow's program. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We have some calls that have come in, so let's go to a couple of them now before we get to the early years of the new president of Iran. And we start with Saeed in Green Bay. Hi, Saeed.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. I think that we need to curb our enthusiasm that real reform is underway in Iran, because that is not the case. The real reformists are either dead, in prison, or exiled. The real political contention in Iran is not between Rouhani and the conservatives. It is between those who don't believe in the concept of the velayat al-faqih, or the rule of the jurist, which is a substantial majority. We know it's a substantial majority because in this election, as in previous election 2009 and ones before it, when the Iranians have a chance to vote even for a facade of reform, they do so enthusiastically and in great numbers. Unfortunately, the experience of Khatami and the previous election in 2009 shows us that reform within this system is not possible. The system is reform-proof. So what is the news of this election? The news of this election is not that the conservatives are in retreat. It is that the conservatives feel so strongly in control that they will allow a Rouhani to come in. We know that if they were seriously threatened, as they were in 2009 by Mousavi, they will even cheat the election. Even an election whose candidates have been vetted by the Guardian Council. So the fact that they will allow Rouhani to be elected only demonstrates the strength of their hand that they feel. And so the implications of this for U.S. policy are profound. If we mistakenly believe that real reform is underway and ease sanctions, it will be the exact wrong thing.
Professor? Can you?
Hello?
Yes, go. Did you hear that, Professor?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I don't think the issue is between reform or change of the regime. I think from the U.S. point of view, the question is the nuclear issue, and is it possible to have a settlement with Rouhani? And from his background and what he's said before in his negotiations, he is clearly much more forthcoming than Ahmadinejad was on the nuclear issue. So instead of U.S. policy being concerned about whether the system is reformable or not, the issue should the United States be what is possible about the nuclear issue. And here I think actually the ball is in the American court now. It's the U.S. has to decide whether they're going to offer something that's negotiable to the Iranian side, or are they going to be intransigent, as U.S. has been in the last few years, over the nuclear issue. Here, usually the whole discourse is surrounded as if the other side is the real problem. Ahmadinejad was a problem, but there was also a problem on this side. Now, I think with Rouhani, there is less of a problem from the Iranian side, but a greater problem from the U.S. side. If the U.S. continues on its present negotiating stand, which is Iran has to immediately stop all nuclear enrichment, Iran has to account for all the past misdeeds before 2003, and that it has to, in fact, open up all its nuclear facilities to the United States. That's basically a non-starter. Rouhani, however much he may want to negotiate, he can't negotiate on those grounds. If, on the other hand, the Obama administration reiterates what Obama, the candidate, said, which is U.S. has no objection to Iran having nuclear enrichment, but its objection is a nuclear weapons policy, that would be good grounds to start negotiations. But we have to wait and see what basically U.S. is going to offer Iran. So before we jump to the conclusion that this regime is the real threat or a real obstacle to negotiations, we have to actually see what the U.S. position is on this issue.
Thanks, Saeed, for your call. Let's go to Mike in Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, well, you know, I agree completely with your first caller. In essence, I don't think it matters who is elected president, because ultimately the final decision, let's say with regards to the nuclear program, is going to be somebody else's. So, you know, we could talk until we're blue in the face about his childhood and all of that, but, you know, in essence, does it really mean anything? And this notion of, you know, what is the U.S.'s position? The U.S.'s position is very clear. No nuclear weapons. Apart from that, you know, I don't understand your guest point of view that, you know, now it depends on the Americans. Our point of view is very clear and has been stated very clearly.
Would you agree it's meaningless who the president of Iran is, Professor?
Well, I'm glad he knows what the U.S. position is. I would love to know, be sure that was what U.S. position is, that U.S. wants Iran not to have a nuclear weapon. That would be good, but if there is something more than that, if it's the U.S. position is that Iran should not have any nuclear program, shouldn't even have nuclear scientists, shouldn't have any enrichment, then, of course, it's a non-starter. And when someone says clearly that I know what the U.S. position is, I'm a bit suspicious of that, because I've been trying to unravel what the U.S. position is, and it's not that clear. What is Obama said in his campaigns was very different than what has been said after he came into office. So we have, before we sort of condemn Iran as the obstacle, we have to also look at what the U.S. positions are. Rouhani, being a much smarter negotiator than Ahmadinejad, is going to actually reach out to the other members of the European community and could easily drive a wedge between Europe and the United States if he's forthcoming and the U.S. is not forthcoming. It's forgotten that when Rouhani was a negotiator on the nuclear issue, he actually won over the French on this argument. Chirac actually agreed with him that there could be a settlement. It was the U.S. at that time that was the obstacle.
You bring to light his negotiating skills, and they're evidently quite something. You call him a firm, tough negotiator, but a constructive negotiator, which is pretty meaningful when it comes to negotiations on this very issue, right?
Yes, yeah. I mean, he would be, as a negotiator, he would want to know from the United States, what does the U.S. want? And then you can then go from that. If the U.S. wants guarantees that Iran is not going to weaponize, then he could argue, well, we can give you these guarantees. But if U.S. position is that we can't trust you with any nuclear technology, then obviously then there's nowhere he can go to negotiate about that.
Mm. There obviously is a huge difference in the personality of the new president compared with Ahmadinejad, who was incredibly inflammatory rhetoric all the time. It would seem to me as though that makes a difference in how willing you are as any country to negotiate with Iran. He must have been one tough guy to negotiate with because of some of the outrageous things he said.
Yes, but we have to keep in mind, actually, on the nuclear issue, he wasn't negotiating with the U.S. It was Jalali
and Jalali was also very sort of intransigent. But the stuff that Ahmadinejad was basically spouting and causing problems really didn't directly have to do with the nuclear negotiations. It was much more to do about Israel and the Holocaust. And these are sort of issues that Rouhani is not going to try to get involved in.
Mm-hmm. But if you're the face, he was certainly the public face of Iran all over the world for a long period of time. When you thought of Iran, you thought of him. So it would seem to me as though on all issues, if he, flamboyant as he was the face of the country, then wouldn't it be hard to have a serious other side doing these kinds of negotiations?
Yeah, I mean, also he was erratic. I mean, for many years he said he couldn't really negotiate with the United States, but then in the last year he actually said the only way to deal with this was directly with the United States. So there was a complete somersault on his position. And this also undermined his credibility in Iran. On one hand, he would be very intransigent, very sort of saber-rattling. On the other hand, he was also said would be willing to offer an olive branch to the United States on the nuclear issue. So people got very confused about what his position was. But, you know, his real problem wasn't so much that. The real problem is he was, in a way, undermining the clerical structure by becoming an evangelical preacher.
Mm-hmm.
Here there are a lot of parallels with U.S. politics. There's about 20% of the Iranian electorate that resonates with evangelical talk. And when you say that the Messiah is about to return and he has direct communications with the Messiah, this really rubs the clerical hierarchy the wrong way. And it might appeal to about 20% of the population, but it doesn't appeal to the 80% of the population. So that's, in a way, put him in a marginalized his appeal.
Mm-hmm. Our guest this hour is Ervand Abrahamian. He's a distinguished professor of Iranian and Middle Eastern history and politics, born in Iran and raised in England, author of many books. Iran Between Two Revolutions. He's currently working on the CIA coup in Iran and a history of modern Iran. We're talking about the victory, the election of the cleric Hassan Rouhani in the presidential race over the weekend and what it means for Iran and what it means for negotiations on nuclear issues with the Iranians, what it means for that part of the world, and the list goes on. Our phone number, if you would like to join our conversation, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And you can always leave messages on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. John in Madison, hello.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I wonder if it would be a good idea for the United States to apologize for having overthrown the Mossadegh government like in the late 50s. We did overthrow their government and install a puppet of the Shah. Would that do any good to apologize for that?
I wouldn't say it's a precondition. I think, I mean, the U.S. has come pretty close to it. And on the Iranian side, some of the reformers have been pretty close to apologizing for the hostage taking. So, I mean, it would clear the air a bit to clear some of the historical problems. But the real problems aren't, I don't think, historical. The real problems is the nuclear issue and whether the U.S. is willing to accept the Islamic Republic as a legitimate state in the Middle East.
Anything else, John? John is gone. And yet you have to look at the history of all of this because it's how things develop the way they are today in some ways. You write about the new president's family reportedly opposing the former Shah of Iran and their son studying religion at a very early age. So who he is informed by that past, right?
Yes, I mean, I think he has actually a sort of very interesting background. He's not from a clerical family, He comes from much more lower middle class business family, but he studied theology. And more interestingly enough, he studied also Sharia law in Glasgow, which gives him a different perspective. He actually taught his dissertation, our MA thesis, was on pragmatism in a Shia version of Sharia. So in a way, he has a Western education, and he obviously has a turban and so on, but he also has basically a higher degree from a British university.
When you look at his thesis that he wrote on the flexibility of Sharia Islamic law, where does he see flexibility?
Well, there are two versions of the Sharia. One is, you could say, the Salafi, the sort of so-called purist version, that there is one, you know, clear-cut Sharia established by the Prophet and the early caliphs and so on. Then there's a much more liberal, flexible interpretation that you have to adopt from different times, different cultures, and, of course, it's something that can be more expanded as time goes on. And he clearly belongs to this sort of much more liberal interpretation of how the original Sharia should be adopted in the 21st century.
Why do you think he was given the go-ahead to even run here?
Well, one thing is, I don't think the Supreme Leader had a strong opposition to him. If he had, of course, he could have got the Guardian Council to veto him. So in a way, there was enough trust for the Supreme Leader to say that he'd be okay. But why he... also, another thing would be that it's always in politics miscalculation. It could be that the Guardian Council didn't really expect him to win, because if you'd looked back a month before the election, he was just one of many and didn't seem to be really cutting much ice with the public. So this is often a surprise that comes in Iranian presidential elections, that what happens in the last 4 or 5 days in the campaign, it takes people by surprise. So he could have been taken as another candidate who's not very colorful, would be pretty acceptable to the establishment, and therefore, why not let him run? And this, of course, happened with Khatami in the 1990s. Again, he won a landslide victory with no one expecting him to win at all, because he really wasn't a household name until a week before the election.
Were you surprised by Rouhani's victory?
Yes, I was.
You were?
Yeah.
Who did you think would win?
Well, I thought most reformers would stay home.
Oh.
And again, if you looked at a month before the election, this was what people's attitude was. Well, he's just like the rest of them. Why bother to vote? And then, of course, in the last few days, especially with Khatami and Rafsanjani coming out in his support and he making some statements that clearly were appealing to reformers, that energized enough reformers to come out and vote.
Mm-hmm. We're welcoming more phone calls. Our guest this hour, as we talk about the Iranian presidential election over the weekend, Ervan Abrahamian, distinguished professor of Iranian and Middle Eastern history and politics at City University of New York. He is the author of a number of books. He's right now working on a book on the CIA coup in Iran and also a history of modern Iran. Also, he is the author of The Iranian Mojahideen, Two Revolutions, Between Two Revolutions, Khomeinism, Torture Confessions, and Inventing the Axis of Evil. Here's our phone number if you would like to join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, Andrew Carroll will be joining us. Andrew spent 4 years traveling to all 50 states by all modes of transportation to satisfy his curiosity about forgotten American history. It's a fascinating book. It's little snippets of American history that really have very large consequences and implications. And he has written about all of this in his new book, Here Is Where, Discovering America's Great Forgotten History. He'll be with us hour two of our show. And you can join us this hour. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This message comes in from a listener asking, not only did the people dance in the streets, there was an incredible outpouring of enthusiasm. All of those people who were on the streets exhibiting that kind of enthusiasm were looking for what from the new president, do you think?
I think what the enthusiasm was that one is change from Ahmadinejad, because his basically performance, economic, international, had put so many people off.
Mm.
But then the other thing is that any hope for opening up of the system, that's, you can use the word reform or whatever, but I think what it really is talking, the people want, is a sort of glasnost, an opening of the Islamic Republic, and more room for people to breathe. Questions like, you know, dress, what music you listen to, what you can write in newspapers, and so on. These are, I think, affects directly the average citizen, and they've been suffocating the last 8 years under a very sort of throttling administration.
Okay.
So they don't expect huge changes. They don't expect overthrow of the Islamic Republic, but somehow an opening where there'll be more room for the people who are not really part of the regime itself.
Did he talk extensively during the campaign about social reform, and if so, what did he say?
Well, no, he talked indirectly about economic plight of people. And, of course, people realize that much of the economic plight is due to Ahmadinejad's bad economic policies, mismanagement, and partly it's due to the sanctions. And, of course, the sanctions are related to the nuclear issue. So by talking about the need for economic improvement, he was, in fact, tapping into public discontent with Ahmadinejad's both internal and external policies in the last 8 years.
Mm-hmm. What has he said about Israel?
He hasn't said much about Israel, and he wouldn't. I think his policy would be, you know, most Iranians would support, that they sympathize with the Palestinian cause. They will help the Palestinians, you know, internationally. But it's not really something immediate to them to get directly involved in. So raising issues about existence of Israel or supporting Hamas or rather than the PLO and stuff, these issues, I think he would feel like most Iranians, this is not something Iran has vested interest to get involved in. So like most Iranians, they would sympathize with the Palestinian plight and would internationally at the UN support it, but would not want to get directly involved in the nitty-gritty of it. And
mm-hmm.
I think Ahmadinejad, in a way, got burnt on that issue. He became more Palestinian than the Palestinians, was supporting Hamas, and, of course, Hamas turned out not to support Iran when it came to issues such as Syria. So I think they've got burnt on that issue.
Let's go back to the nuclear issue for a moment. You talked earlier about what it is that the United States wants and Iran needing a clear explanation of that. You have written during the recent election, it was argued that it was again time to change tactics in the nuclear program and reduce international pressure on Iran. The election result shows that people want a change in the nuclear policy, which led me to wonder what is it that the people in Iran, if they've been able to express this, may want in this area?
It's hard to tell because it's not something that the papers are allowed to discuss openly. What I think most experts would say, the average Iranian is willing to support Iran's desire to have nuclear technology, but the public isn't interested in nuclear weaponry. And that's, of course, the position of also the regime, and that's something then the U.S. could negotiate with. But if the U.S. position is that Iran shouldn't have any nuclear technology and couldn't be trusted with it, then, of course, the Iranian public would support its own regime rather than the U.S. position on that.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the reformists for just a moment here. It's interesting, these responses to the election. The political editor at the Reformist newspaper said he is the right man for the job. He's a modern cleric and a diplomat, which is useful in foreign and domestic politics. And then you, in an article you wrote, said a reformist politician said the very fact that he is elected shows that he's very much accepted by our establishment. How can you please both?
Well, there's a, I would say, different spectrum of what reformers expect and what how you define a reformer. I mean, people who describe themselves as reformers could be also people who want opening up incremental changes. There are also people who are so alienated that feel there is no possibility of even reform. So they're talking about reform, but really what they feel like, the whole system has to be overthrown, i.e. to have a revolution. But frankly, I don't think the general public in Iran is in a mood for another revolution. What they do really want is opening, however gradual it is, of the system, rather than another major overthrow. They've lived through that, and it's not something that the average person would be eager to embrace.
Mm-hmm. And if you could please describe, although we have yet to see what this plays out, but you talk about this president being elected but still having to survive in a system that has existed before the election. Can you talk a little bit more about that system?
Well, the system is actually very complex. It's probably one of the most complex constitutions. The president is the head of the executive, but over the executive is, of course, this looming power of the supreme leader, who can undercut the president. But then there are two ways of interpreting the role of the supreme leader. One is a leader in the Western sense that he actually leads the country. The other one, which so many of the writers of the Iranian constitution would argue, was no, it's the leader isn't someone who leads. He's more like a guide, sort of generally talking about guidelines, but not dictating to the president or the judiciary or the legislature or what they should do. And that if there is any sort of gridlock between the various branches, then the supreme leader can come in and try to compromise or sort out the differences. So there is, even within the Iranian constitution, different ways of interpreting what the position of the leader is. The president obviously has a great deal of influence. He can't dictate, but he can, in a way, mold Iran's a position in the world, as Ahmadinejad did in a bad way. He could do it in a good way, like Khatami did. Forget during the 1990s. Khatami had a great deal of popular support outside the world. And he was undermined actually by the United States, because when he offered to settle all the issues with the United States, the Bush administration basically slapped him in the face, and that showed that the sort of reform position was not going to settle the issues.
Thank you so much for your informative hour. Our guest, Professor Ervand Abrahamian, he's professor of Iranian and Middle Eastern history at SUNY, author of A History of Modern Iran. We also thank Brian Murphy from the AP. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this show. Thanks to KP Whaley as well.